Uncle Don here with the 279th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. The station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake, or CHLS in Lillooet. Sorry about that. Welcome aboard for a half hour of Olympics-free radio, a seldom-heard 30 minutes, without breathless reports of heroic achievements by steroid-enhanced jocks and jockettes, striving to outperform one another in feats of running, jumping, throwing, and other meaningless displays of wasted energy and ability. I will discuss the Olympic business in China, and business it is, but only as it applies to reality. These games open China to the world, improving the lot of the average citizens, while bestowing upon them the glories of justice, liberty, democracy, and freedom. This will mark the greening of the Middle Kingdom. Bullshit. Well, that's what the Olympic Committee was promised when they accepted China's bid. There was to be no censorship of news during the games. There would be no hardships for their people from forced relocations. The environment would be cleaned up. Rights would be respected. It's obvious that once a city is selected by the committee as a venue, all promises go out the window. There are no penalties for failing to meet obligations. When preparations begin, there's no turning back. And so it is in Vancouver. There are to be no forced relocations, yet speculators have been allowed to close single-room occupancy hotels, evicting long-time tenants in order to make room for Olympic visitors. Rushed construction of a subway line from the airport to downtown has bankrupted businesses along the route while fouling traffic. It's evident that the billion-dollar reconstruction of Highway 99 is not making this route safe as promised. Campbell's government and its NDP predecessor promised that the Games will put British Columbia on the map and bring prosperity. Funny thing, but I thought that Expo 86 was supposed to do that job. Now all I see is massive red ink for citizens as billions are squandered on venues that will become tomorrow's white elephants requiring endless subsidies, even as our taxes pay off the construction debts. I say that Olympic exercises are wasteful and useless, and I say to hell with them. We know the real reasons behind the ongoing Olympics in China. Sure, the Chinese want to demonstrate to the world that they've become a member of the family of developed nations, or at least Beijing has. They have world-class smog, polluted water, a class of billionaires, downtrodden workers. What more could they need to join the club? This hides the fact that Olympics are about money. Moving public money into private purses, opening opportunities for successful athletes to sell endorsements, and opportunities for corporations to lavish great wads of tax-deductible money into advertising. Expenses for ad spending are in the neighborhood of $6 billion. Television viewers see corporate names on costumes, billboards, and commercials. Do these ads work? Do consumers come away from their idiot boxes saying that a General Motors ad was really great, so let's buy a Hummer? I don't know. As for me, when I see an expensive advertisement, whether on a billboard or as a full-page newspaper or magazine ad, I'm mindful that part of that cost comes off taxes that the corporations will not be paying to support governments, and part is added to the prices of branded goods. Since I do not subject myself to television, even in my dentist's office, I don't have corporations intruding into my home, telling me what my needs are. It's amazing the things and services we find that other people need that we don't. But then I'm a troglodyte, and what do I know? I'm the guy who thought that Paris Hilton was a hotel. But there is a higher power. No, not the dubious one driving a Kansas Baptist church to propose picketing the funeral of Tim McLean, victim of the maniac Greyhound bus killer. These lunatics claim that McLean's murder proves that their God hates Canada and that killing was a divine gift. Well, God loved Job, and look what it got him. Maybe we're better off if they're right. No, my higher power is the power that has finally arrived at CFUR, boosting its broadcast range by taking us from 5 watts to about 200. We now operate on a regular license instead of a developmental one. A new antenna has been installed on the roof of the UNBC library, giving direction to our higher power. Finally, our favorite program, Democracy Now!, should be clearly heard in our neck of the woods. Hallelujah! Now here's a sterling example of hypocrisy. Western nations demand that Iran cease refining uranium, as it was supposedly violates the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is the West public stance, as they claim the sanctity of this 40-year-old agreement. In 1968, there were five nuclear powers, which just happened to be the permanent members of the UN Security Council. They agreed, and got other nations to agree, that they would retain a monopoly on nuclear weapons. They enticed non-nuclear states to sign by including a pledge that they would pursue negotiations in good faith to eliminate their stockpiles of these weapons. 4 decades later, those negotiations have borne little fruit and stockpiles remain. In spite of the hypocrisy of those nations in disregarding their obligations, they insist that Iran avoid joining the nuclear club. They candidly admit that Iran is entitled under that treaty to develop nuclear power for civil use, but that right is irrelevant. Iran must bow to international pressure to cease refining uranium or face increasing sanctions and perhaps attack and invasion. While Iran is being held to the letter and beyond of that non-proliferation treaty, it's informative to view how other nations are treated. Israel is sitting on an arsenal of about 200 nuclear bombs, an accomplishment achieved with the aid of France in clear violation of French obligations under the treaty. Israel refuses to acknowledge this stockpile, as it would imply a reciprocal right of its neighbors to build their own. But this is all right, as Israel is a good guy and can do no wrong. Pakistan has a nuclear arsenal, but that's all right, as they are good guys, in spite of their aiding our Afghan enemies. India has nuclear weapons, weapons made with U-235 derived from reactors supplied by Canada. In order to get those CANDU reactors, they had to pledge not to use their products for weapons, but their lapse can be forgiven, as they are good guys. Besides, they need atomic bombs to offset Pakistan's. The United States of America is the prime good guy, by definition. It needn't adhere to any treaties, including the non-proliferation one. Therefore, it is cool in Canada's eyes for them to ignore the parts of that treaty which forbid any of the five official nuclear powers to aid an outsider which is in violation of the treaty. This is India in this case. Bush's United States has entered into an agreement with India for civil nuclear cooperation. Our own expert on duplicity, David Emerson, the man who jumped parties for personal power, stated in an interview, quote, "You can't keep somebody in the penalty box forever." Sorry, David, nuclear proliferation is not a hockey game, and in spite of what some Canadians might think, it is more important to human survival. And why does Canada have to go along with this overt violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? I guess the first reason is that Stephen Harper's mentor, George Wanker Bush, violates them with impunity. The second is that India is emerging as an economic power and must be indulged. The principle here is evident. Treaties, agreements, and even the United Nations Charter itself are to be rigidly applied only to the weak, while strong nations are free to violate them at will. There were those dreamers who thought that they had fought World War II to bring order and justice in relations between nations weak and strong. Those who sacrificed and died for this ideal seem to have wasted their efforts and their lives. I'm not idle in my retirement. Besides wasting endless hours coming up with topics for these shows, I have other chores. I usually do the laundry, I mow the lawn, shovel the snow, and move the firewood. My wife does the cooking under threat that I might subject her tender digestive system to my clumsy efforts, but I do the cleanup. Now I have an added duty which I inflicted upon myself. I must find a profitable way of disposing of a massive comic book collection bequeathed to me by my late brother. 2 huge cartons with a total weight of 40 kilograms arrived on our doorstep last Saturday. I've been sorting through this accumulation, which I hesitate to call a collection, as there seems to have been no order to this mess. I guess John bought them when and where the opportunity arose. He used them to be in the flea market racket, so I suppose he purchased odd lots. I spent hours sorting this lot, culling a stack of duplicates a good 30 centimeters high. This massive pile includes remnants of my childhood collection. The oldest one I have unearthed goes back as far as 1949, the year of my brother's birth. The bulk of them are from the 80s. I will award a free comic or two to anyone who can guide me in disposal of these old classics. Remember all those movies where the cops tell the prisoner, "You have the right to remain silent"? In the U.S., this is enshrined in the Sixth Amendment to their Constitution, where it states that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. In Canada, Section 11 of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms says, in a more convoluted fashion, Any person charged with an offense has the right not to be compelled to be a witness in proceedings against that person in respect of that offense. What a surprise it was to the American military tribunal trying Osama bin Laden's driver in occupied Cuba when the judge barred evidence extracted from his captive when he was subjected to highly coercive conditions in occupied Afghanistan. That judge must have actually read his Bill of Rights. It looks like there's a spark of humanity left in the U.S. Army when such a judgment can still be made. It wasn't much of a stretch to define compelled to be a witness to cover sleep deprivation, being shackled hand and foot 24 hours a day while in isolation, and being knocked to the ground while having a bag tied over his head. It would be interesting to read the justifications for this treatment of rationale for admitting testimony thus extracted. Now, there may be hope that the extreme treatment accorded Canadian Omar Khadr will make his extracted statements inadmissible, thus blowing the government's only evidence against him. If this judicial decision is upheld, maybe this will begin a movement culminating in the dismantling of the dungeons in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and all the secret prisons the U.S. is operating around the planet. Again and again we hear from Harper and his mouthpieces that Canada must reduce the terrible tax burden on corporations to remain competitive. Pity the poor shoeless corporate executive struggling to feed his family on the pitiful millions left for his compensation after our rapacious taxes. The global auditing firm KPMG LLP did a study of business taxation in 10 countries, finding that total taxation in Canada is higher only than Mexico and the Netherlands. Ahead of us in total taken by governments is Australia, the U.S., the U.K., Japan, Germany, Italy, and France. Think of this study the next time conservatives tell you that taxes have to be shifted further from corporations to workers and consumers. In the first full year of the Harper regime, our federal government spent $80 million on advertising. This begs the question of why our government has to advertise to its people. Citizens need to know what their governments are doing, but isn't that the job of the media to tell us? Granted that there are some ads mandated by legislation, but these information pieces are a small chunk of what we're exposed to. The armed forces might advertise for military recruits, but let them remain in the help wanted pages, not in full-page spreads replete with patriotic symbols and blurbs. Canadians had hoped that governments had learned their lesson about throwing our money around on advertising after the Liberal sponsorship scandal. But no, we have to hear what a great job our minority conservatives are doing as stewards of our money, and they're willing to put a lot of our money into the project. Advertising has its place in a competitive environment, but for a monopoly like government or Hydro, I don't need glossy ads to tell me that government is supposedly doing the job they were elected for, or that I should use electricity. Some people have all the luck. Take that fortunate lottery ticket selling family in Jellicoe, Ontario, some 200 kilometers north of Thunder Bay. Between 1995 and 2004, they won 167 lottery prizes for a total value of $1,279,328. Not bad for a little convenience store at a crossroads. For reasons best known to investigators, this has aroused suspicions of the Ontario Lottery and Gambling Corporation and the Ontario Provincial Police. They closed their inquiries after finding no evidence of wrongdoing. Barry Johnson, his wife, and five sons raked in this remarkable winnings by violating laws of odds and statistics, if nothing else. Considering the rate of payouts from lotteries, I would expect that this kind of return would have come from no less than $3 million in ticket purchases. One of the boys stated, my dad's always been lucky, no matter what. There's no dirt on the family. We just got lucky, that's all. I would like to know their system. If I had it, I could be Prime Minister and clean up Ottawa. Don't you wonder how, in a supposedly democratic political environment, a small minority can hijack economic benefits of growth while the majority, those who do real work in society, stagnate? In North America's last three decades, lower classes' real incomes have been level. Meanwhile, the wealthy top few percentage have seen their incomes and wealth increase exponentially. This isn't left-wing propaganda, it's statistical fact. Since the working class will always outnumber those whose fancy incomes come from owning assets or exorbitant salaries, one would expect that a functioning democracy to be more egalitarian. Ah, but there's the rub. Our democracy is not functioning. It was not designed to function as a vehicle for the welfare of the hoi polloi. In the earliest days of North American democracy, voting was restricted to white men of property. No women, no workers, no slaves. The accepted principle among this group, of course, was that those who owned the nation should govern it. It seems evident to them. In both the United States and Canada, limited democracy was allowed by our founders, only with safeguards. Each government had an unelected Senate of worthies with the power to stymie legislation. Each had a Supreme Court to overturn radical legislation threatening the status quo. And finally, each had a legislature with members selected to represent specific geographical areas. Boundaries of these areas are manipulated by the legislatures themselves to divide and minimize the power of majorities. The system is the same within provinces, states, and our federal governments. Globalization is a tool used to reduce barriers to trade and labor between political jurisdictions. With barriers down, corporations play one nation against another in their quest for needed investment and employment. It's no wonder that Chrysler is making a deal with Nissan to produce cars overseas for the North American market. This once powerful provider of jobs and business on our continent is becoming merely a marketing arm of a company producing in Third World, where wages are lower, health and safety regulations minimal, and governments prevent unions. Many, if not most, companies which were formerly the backbone of communities here are just shells flogging goods made by desperate laborers in the Third World. Mulroney's free trade agreement with the U.S. saw manufacturing jobs migrate from Ontario to anti-union, low-wage states of the old Confederacy. Then the other shoe dropped when Mulroney, again the bad guy, got us into NAFTA deal expanding the concept to include Mexico. Corporations then packed up from the Old South and into the maquiladoras. With further reduction of international trade barriers and pressure from the likes of Malwart demanding lower prices, manufacturing again shifted from Mexico to China. Now China is watching some of their more labor-intensive industries go off to Vietnam. What will be the next destination for fat corporations seeking to squeeze the last penny from workers? Is this what's behind the move to colonize Mars? It seemed inevitable that those in Canada and the U.S. whose living standards stagnate while good jobs move overseas would flex their political muscle and force change. Under democracy, the majority has this power. They could begin by bringing back tariffs on imported goods made with underpaid labor, unsafe working conditions, and without environmental protections. Then they could go after a tax structure that fails to bring a fair return from those making exorbitant incomes. But neither is happening. We have a shining example in New York, a jurisdiction facing a multi-billion-dollar deficit. Over the past decades, they have reduced taxes on multi-million-dollar incomes by 50%. Now, in order to dent their deficit, a proposal has been floated to increase income tax on those people by 1%. This proposal has been vetoed by the mayor, who said that this huge increase would drive the rich out of the city. The proposal has died at the hands of those who find taxes a burden rather than a price they pay for a civilized environment. If we peasants are to storm this bastille of power appropriated by the rich, we'd better get on with it before the last of our rights are stifled by the security state behind the guise of making us safe from social progress. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. So what are the chances of a righteous uprising of angry citizens? Not much. As the average person immerses himself or herself in the nonsense of athletic competitions in Beijing, there's a barely noted war raging between Georgia and Russia that threatens to spread across Central Asia. But women's volleyball is so much more entertaining. Neil Reynolds, one of my favorite far-right commentators, tells us that half of all the U.S. voters don't know that their state has two elected senators. 40% cannot name either senator nor the party he or she represents. Half know the name of their congressman. Similar degrees of ignorance are evident in Canada, but such statistics are not as well polled here. If citizens have only the foggiest of ideas as to how their current governments operate, what chance is there of changing them? And if change does not come about, is it not likely that the unwashed will cleave to the man on a white horse, promising to cleanse the land and rid it of those who oppressed them. Well, it worked for Hitler, Mussolini, Mugabe, and Stalin. Surely we could find someone here to come riding forth, perhaps on a jet ski, offering to save us if we will just give him dictatorial power. One of the promises elevating the right horrible Stephen Harper and his toadies to minority power was one of clean and open accountability. It was proven to be so. Harper's governance has been transparent, like a clean window pane. That is, it is invisible. What we know of conservative rule is embodied in press releases, slick advertising, and comments carefully vetted by the Prime Minister's bloated office and in heavily redacted bits, pried loose reluctantly through access to information requests. An interesting piece of window dressing brought in by Harper was conflict of interest legislation requiring the timely reporting of public servants of gifts valued at over $200. Regulations require these reports within 30 days of receipt. It's come to light that one public servant, Stephen Harper, has failed to report such gifts for the last 6 months. The PMO's excuse for this lapse is that all of these tributes must be appraised for their market value. How is one to evaluate the precious donation by Steve's mentor, George Wanker Bush, of a desk decorated with antlers? This is probably a poor gift to attack, as its market value could be negative, as few people would lug such a monstrosity home from the swap shed. But behind the brouhaha over Harper's lapses is a question begged. Why are our public servants allowed to accept valuable gifts at all? A gift generates an obligation above and beyond that of caring for the needs of constituents. Without putting too fine a point on it, a gift bears some of the attributes of a bribe. I was a civil servant over the years. I worked for the U.S., Australian, and Canadian federal governments. I worked for a township in the States. I've collected a paycheck from the British Columbia government. In none of these positions was I allowed to accept a gift from anyone. It was explicitly prohibited, and such would have been cause for dismissal. Before looking at the fine points of reporting gifts, we should be looking at why there are gifts at all allowed to our public servants. Prince George's City fathers and mothers are always striving for ways to bring prosperity to our community in the face of ice jam flooding, disappearing jobs, air that can be chewy, and decimated pine forests. Yes, they make wise investments on our behalf, like spending $4 million to break up ice that would, in the normal course of events, melt, relieving the flood swamping homes and businesses unwisely built on a floodplain. And they chose to aid in revitalizing the city center by investing $3 million of our money in a fancy underground parking lot at the same time as they will be removing parking meters from city streets. And this parking lot was constructed mainly to service the gorgeous new casino that John Major intends to close after 4 months of operation, leaving another vacant building downtown. But subcapitalist enterprises are thriving and competing without an infusion of tax dollars. Drug dealing is such a profitable enterprise that three unincorporated businesses are competing for the trade. The stimulus to our economy is not evident to most of us, unless we happen to be downtown during a drive-by shooting, or if we live near a crack shack. From a sixth-floor window at the Royal Bank building just last week, I was shown a view of an alley from which tenants could watch drug deals transacted any day. But look on the bright side. The activities of these businesses are making Kevlar a fast-selling fashion item for those with a taste for adventure, luring them to city streets. And crack shacks occupy houses that might otherwise blight neighborhoods by standing vacant. Certainly Prince George's economy is stimulated by money circulating from drug dealing. Look at the traffic in hot merchandise accumulated by desperate addicts. Only the other day, at the corner of George Street and Fifth Avenue, I was offered a pair of speakers of dubious origin by a slightly battered and quite inebriated independent street merchant. Our dutiful city council was assiduous in granting zoning variances to the likes of Mallwart, Home Depot, and Canadian Tire, allowing them to set up enterprise outside of the downtown core. Now that the center is dying, no amount of renovation is likely to bring it back from its decay, vandalism, and drug-dealing aura. Uncle Don can't have a program without taking a kick at the Afghanistan can. As our 90th Canadian returns from that benighted land in a box, our government plans for a permanent war. Although our Parliament reluctantly authorized the occupation to last only through 2011. Purchases of equipment appropriate to that occupation are planned well past that date. Will Canada bring the troops home in 3 years, regardless of whoever runs in the government then? Not likely. With both Obama and McCain promising to stay over there and fight to the last Afghan, it seems likely that little Canada will remain the fawning fall guy, sending our troops and treasure to be sacrificed in a campaign that is none of the Americans' business nor ours. But we mustn't offend Big Brother by refusing to clean up his messes. Then there's the matter of our purchases of American military equipment. We demand offsetting investments in Canada when we buy their lethal toys. So, when we contract to buy Boeing warplanes, that company will spend the equivalent of the contract, before overruns, on building toys here. But there is a problem. American law does not allow dual nationals of certain countries to work on their sensitive killing machines for fear of the dreaded security leak or sabotage. The Canadian Charter of Rights does not allow discrimination in employment based on national origin. During this impasse, the flow of armaments from the U.S. to Canada forces is stymied. I have a humble suggestion. Let us buy our war material, if such is really needed, from other nations, which will gladly unload their overflow of military production. For instance, there is a delay in delivering American helicopters for troops in Afghanistan. In the interim, we'll be leasing Russian model choppers. If they're good enough to lease, let us buy them. The Russians certainly know what kind of machines are needed in Afghanistan, as they preceded our occupation of that land with their own. I thought that Stephen Harper's role model was George Bush the Lesser. It now seems that he also has taken a page from the book of the late unlamented Richard Nixon. When the Liberals held a caucus in Nova Scotia a while ago, Harper sent a spy to the meeting. His choice, unfortunately for him, was Michael White, a senior communications aide to the government House leader. He was sent in disguise of a sort that might have worked 30 years ago. He wore a bright yellow sports shirt and his hair was spiky. Was Harper really stupid enough to send someone like this to do his dirty work? And was this clown just cover for a real spy who fit right in? Such ploys have worked in the past, but no matter how you slice it, this smacks of Nixonian dirty tricks. I was pleased to hear Gordon Campbell clarify the issue of the revenue neutrality of his new carbon tax on fuels. British Columbians now know that each dollar we pay in these new taxes will be precisely offset by a dollar spent on increased pay for senior bureaucrats. Rest assured that with the coming exodus of these men and women into retirement, we will continue to pay these increases as pensions are based on their best year's wages. As for me, I would like to believe that people in high government office are there because they want to serve the public and not merely for high salaries. Besides, we needn't match or better wages of other jurisdiction. Hasn't our own government declared that British Columbia is the best place on earth to live? Isn't that enough to draw qualified servants? This has been the 279th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on now powerful CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenay Lake and CHLS in Lillooet.